This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Someone crack out the Vidi printer. Sensational City sinks 7, S-E-V-E-N, against Leeds. Were Bielsa's side as bad as their manager said, or was it just Manchester City at their scintillating best? The Dean Smith derby ends with a Steven Gerrard win as Villa move into the top half of the table for the first time this season. More postponements as COVID continues to cause concerns with confirmed cases across the Premier League and Championship. What more, though, can clubs do? Arsenal lay down the law as Arteta strips Aubameyang of the captaincy. New Premier League rules come into force regarding sponsorship. And computer says no, a farcical Champions League draw leaves UEFA red-faced. All that and more, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Okay, we have a panel. I'm Faye Carruthers sitting in for the lovely Max Rushton, who's sunning himself somewhere in the city of London, or is it Sydney? Can't remember. Right, Barry Glendening, hello, good morning.
Hi Faye, long time no see.
Yes, delightful to see you. Delightful indeed. Paul Watson, nice to meet you.
Good morning.
Johnny Lou, you have managed on the day, well, on a couple of days after Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang gets stripped of the Arsenal captaincy, to yourself manage to get some kind of award for being 25 minutes late for the pod recording. Congratulations to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Am I now captain of Arsenal then?
Yes, by default, because you're more on time than Mr. Aubameyang by the looks of it. What punishments could we give Johnny Lou? Let us know.
Well, there's nothing worse than being the captain of Arsenal, is there, as a punishment?
Wow. That's how we're starting. We're actually starting at the Etihad. Manchester City 7, Leeds United 0. 7 goals, 7 straight league wins for City as well. They were very, very good, weren't they, Barry?
Yeah, they were. You know, as you mentioned in your intro, it was Manchester City at their scintillating best and Leeds United at their scintillating worst. Probably their most diabolical performance under Marcelo Bielsa. And you could tell in his post-match interview, he was genuinely rattled, genuinely hurt, took the blame himself. He didn't use the excuse, because he never does use excuses, that he was missing Liam Cooper, Calvin Phillips and Patrick Bamford, arguably three of his best players. Yeah, it was a terrible performance. It actually occurred to me it's the kind of performance that could conceivably prompt him to resign. I heard on TalkSport yesterday, after the game was over, they had a phone in and some Leeds fan rang in and he wants Big Sam in.
Of course. Where's Alan Kirbishley?
Big Sam or Steve Bruce in to replace Marcelo Bielsa. I would say be careful what you wish for. But I will be interested to see what Bielsa does on the back of this defeat, because he really did look distraught. But it was a wonderful performance from Manchester City. And the thing is, you know, if Manchester City lose key players, they have plenty of backup on the bench. Leeds have very little on the bench. And that's in part Marcelo Bielsa's fault, because he's very fussy about who he signs and he won't spend money just for the sake of spending money.
Difficult times for Bielsa. We really should be talking about City, and we will do in a second. But Paul Watson, we were talking before the pod started, weren't we? And you're actually quite sad in some ways for Marcelo Bielsa and the way Leeds are going this season.
It's not a nice thing to see. I say this as a neutral. I love what Bielsa's done. I have a lot of respect for him. But it was just miserable watching him after the game. He was bordering on nihilistic, you know. It was really quite awful to see him so crushed by a defeat. As you say, like, he's had defeats before, he's had heavy defeats before, but I've never seen him look like — it was like someone realizing Father Christmas didn't exist. It was really horrible to watch, you know. Felt like we planned everything to avoid this. And then it went basically as badly as it could have done. It looked as if they had no plan at all. And the weirdest thing, for as Barry alluded to, is any other manager would be calling out for funds. You know, they'd be saying, understandably, we need a deeper squad. But because of this ideological, you know, stance that he has, he's basically doing the opposite. And it just comes across a little bit like he's sort of taking the punishment, and he continues to take the punishment. But I don't know how long Leeds fans are going to be satisfied with that, because, you know, the squad is clearly shorn of some of its key players, and no manager's gonna really succeed with that lack of players. So I guess it's a question of at what point does that become a problem for his staying at Leeds if he's refusing to strengthen a squad that's clearly on its bare bones.
Yeah, I mean, Tyler Roberts also came off in the first half, so compounding injury problems as well. But is this something to do with Bielsa's style of football, Johnny? And is he the type of manager that perhaps would just say this wasn't good enough? You know, he came out in his post-match, as you said, and said it's the worst performance in his 4 years in charge that he's seen. Could he walk away rather than be pushed out? Is he that type of person?
You know, at any other of Bielsa's clubs, you'd probably say it was a strong possibility. I don't know, we sort of lulled ourselves into thinking that it's going to be different here, because, you know, he's never even made it to a third season at any of his previous clubs. And yet, you know, there was something really quite I think upsetting is the word, actually, but also quite noble as well. I mean, in a world where managers are basically loath to blame, you know, to blame themselves in the slightest, and will in fact seek scapegoats wherever they can find them, there's something really quite moving about the way he steps in front of the camera and says, no, I take for this was my fault, I did not do well enough, like some kind of like some really, you know, heroic Japanese soldier who has failed the nation and now goes on television and just kind of commits seppuku in front of a large crowd. There's a real kind of real kind of honour to that. And the thing is, it's not his fault. It's not entirely his fault. There are circumstances that have conspired against him. Leeds have been really badly hit by COVID earlier in the season, which, as well as denying them players, denied them, you know, training time. But yeah, I mean, I think it's entirely possible that this particular project, you know, as brilliantly as he's done, and as loved as he is, I don't think you'll find you'll find Leeds fans saying, like, you know, calling for his head or anything like that. He is truly loved in that city and at that club. But it is worth wondering, you know, what is the next stage of this project? Because Bielsa has often revitalized teams, but he's rarely done it again at the same place. He's never really had to take a team and then kind of rebuild it and then take it on to the next step, because he's generally gone by then.
It is the first time that Marcelo Bielsa has seen his side concede 7 in a game, and it's Leeds United's joint heaviest defeat in their history as well as a Football League or Premier League club in all competitions, alongside 7 goal defeats to Stoke, an 8-1 in August 1934, West Ham 7-0. In 66, and
you can imagine Bielsa's definitely seen the video footage of that and analysed it.
Yes, in depth, perhaps before this game as well. Talking of records, those ones unwanted, but some wanted ones for Manchester City, because Phil Foden's goal was City's 500th in the Premier League in 207 games under Pep Guardiola, which makes him the quickest manager to reach that landmark as well. Another record too, Jack Grealish's first Premier League goal since the 21st of August, and his first ever Premier League headed goal too. Just throwing all the stats out there at you. I'll do one more, three for luck, shall we? Because Kevin De Bruyne has also been directly involved in 80 goals in just 83 Premier League starts at the Etihad Stadium. That's 30 scored and 50 assisted, which is just fantastic. Is he still Manchester City's best midfielder, Johnny Lou?
I would say, until last night, until the Leeds game, I would have said definitely not. I mean, arguably, he's not really been the same player since Antonio Rudiger smashed his cheek open in the Champions League final in May. And then he went to the Euros despite not being totally fit, and he got, I think, a pain-killing injection to get him through the Italy game and the Portugal game, and kind of limped through the Italy game, and ever since then has been kind of fighting this uphill battle to not just to get fit, but to get up to speed, to get kind of mentally prepared. And so for his, a lot of his performances this season, he has looked like a bit of a passenger, to be honest, which is quite shocking, you know, for someone who's watched Kevin De Bruyne for years and years and knows how good he is. You know, it's there's something quite you know, some pathos to watching De Bruyne at times this season. But you know, he's had a decent spell out of the side. I mean, clearly he's had things to work on physically, and last night he was incredible, and especially the way he was sort of, I don't know, it was like the last kind of 10, 15 minutes and he was chasing around, you know, just searching for that hat trick. You know, he scored two goals and you could tell he was trying to smash it in from everywhere. And it was like this all action hat trick seeking Kevin De Bruyne. So, you know, I'd hesitate to say like he's back. And I'd still kind of hesitate to say he's their best midfielder. Partly because I feel like Pep Guardiola would morally object to that question.
He morally objects to every question, Pep Guardiola.
He'd give you a look. He'd sort of furrow his brow and go like, you know, well, in this team, we don't have midfielders and individuals. We have a connected system, and you know, you cannot just isolate one player. And then he'd sort of give you a little condescending smile.
Second award of the day to you, Johnny, for your Pep Guardiola impression.
The Leeds players, wow guys, wow.
he was very, very complimentary about Leeds United, bearing in mind that his side had just sunk seven past them.
Well, that's never a good sign, Fabe. It's condescending, Pep, because when Wolves gave them a very good game at the weekend and a game from which they should probably have taken a point, he criticised them for not playing football.
Amazing. Can you see, Paul, Manchester City after this performance going on to win the title, or is it too early for that kind of talk?
To be honest, I've sort of always seen them as the front runners. And I'm saying that as someone who is not on record having backed anyone else. No, you know, I do think if you were to look at the title challenges, what I think marks Man City out is just the range of options they have for destroying a team. So, you know, like let's say with De Bruyne just pops up for the fifth goal and lashes one in like that. And you think there's so much talent in that squad. There's talent to just sit on a bench. There's talent, you know, there's more talent on that bench than there is in most mid-table sides. It's very hard to see past Man City. I think Chelsea, if they can become the old Chelsea rather than this new, slightly strange Chelsea that we've seen over the last few weeks, are probably the most realistic challengers. I don't think Liverpool have the depth either. And I think really it is probably just Man City's this year. And I think you have to look at performance like last night. And one thing that really came through is just, like Jonathan was saying, that the hunger to still just keep smashing goals in. And I think it's something quite horrible to watch in a way. It's car crash viewing when a team like Leeds are clearly on their knees. But that kind of hunger to run up the score, I think, says a lot about how many players need to prove themselves in that squad and the level of competition amongst that squad.
Yeah, six different goal scorers as well. Foden, Grealish,
so, including John Stones.
And John Stones.
When John Stones is scoring, and not only John Stones, but by that point it descended in something. It did look like a sort of playground game. That John Stones had time to like have a shot saved, the ball bounced back, and another one saved. You know, it just, at that point it was just beat the keeper, wasn't it really? But when John Stones is scoring past
and
you at
Nathan
that point,
Ake,
I think, it starts to look a little bit embarrassing at that point.
Yeah, it certainly was. There was another game on Tuesday night as well. I'm a bit bored of saying the Dean Smith derby, but it was the Dean Smith derby. Norwich City 0, Aston Villa 2, Jacob Ramsey on the score sheet with an absolute beaut, Ollie Watkins as well. That means Aston Villa are up to ninth, and it's their fourth win in six games since Steven Gerrard took charge. Gerrard wins over Brighton, Palace, Leicester and Norwich, and actually ran Manchester City and Liverpool pretty close. What though, Barry, has he managed to change? It's 39 days since Dean Smith was sacked. As some kind of turnaround, what's he managed to do?
Well, I was being contrarian and referring to this as the Emmy Buendia, just to be different. But
better ring.
I They look a lot more aggressive. Villa, I think, under Gerrard, he has tightened their defence, and he's sort of got two central midfielders who, it's no surprise to see, play quite like he used to play. And Jacob Ramsey, I think, has featured in every game, or maybe started every game since Gerrard came. He clearly sees a bit of himself in Jacob Ramsey. And possibly a Villa support who were obsessing a little over the departure of Jack Grealish should now focus on the other good young players they have coming through into the first team. That seems to be a hallmark of Gerrard's management style. If you are good enough, you will get opportunities, no matter what your age.
Ed Ahrens as well, in his match report, said John McGinn did a decent impression of his new manager. So, I mean, are they all trying to replicate Gerrard at the moment, Johnny?
I think it's certainly one of the things that a good manager can do when they first enter a club. And I think, you know, the signs are that Gerrard is a pretty good manager, is that you impose yourself, you impose your style, and you impose your identity. And sometimes you even kind of impose your character. And the interesting thing about how Villa have played under Gerrard compared to, I guess, how they were earlier this season under Dean Smith, is that I think partly as a result of having Jack Grealish there for so long, and this game-breaking player who could change games and needed a license and needed a certain indulgence and needed to, you know, to basically be given free rein. I think that culturally Villa became the sort of place which was slightly tilted towards its attacking stars over kind of the system as a whole. And that's something that I think crept in gradually, I think. But we saw it this summer when they went and, you know, blew the Grealish money, and we signed three players to replace one player. And of course, you can't play 13 players, so that didn't really work. But they ended up with, I think, a slightly lopsided 11 where certain players in the squad weren't pulling their weight, basically. And what Gerrard has come in and done is he's kind of established a meritocracy again. I mean, the early talk is that he's come in and he doesn't rate Matt Target and he wants a new left back in January, but he's still going to give him a chance in the meantime. You know, he brought what's his name, Chani Chukwuemeka off the bench from the academy, and he's, you know, he had a great second half. He set up Watkins's goal. And so it feels like a more cohesive unit. It feels like a more humble unit. And maybe that's kind of, you know, extrapolating too much from just a few weeks. But that's definitely my early impressions. And that's kind of how Gerrard has imposed himself.
Good from a Villa point of view. But Norwich, I mean, terrible defending for that Jacob Ramsey goal in the first place. But they've only scored 8 goals so far this season in 17 games. We've talked about it plenty of times before, Paul, but it seems to be their biggest issue this season.
Yeah, and I think that's very clear. I think when we saw them against Man United, they deserved a point against United. They could even have grabbed more. But I think what I really feel for with Dean Smith, and what really threw it into sharp relief, was Dean Smith losing the Dean Smith derby. You could sort of see that still, okay, Gerrard's come in and done a great job, but a lot of the Villa players obviously still feel very attached to Dean Smith, and so do the fans. And, you know, Jacob Ramsey is someone he championed, and to see Jacob Ramsey then, you know, cut through that team, slice through them and score, it really underlined the fact that it must be immensely frustrating for Dean Smith to suddenly be at a club where he doesn't really have this base of players, he doesn't really have exciting players like Jacob Ramsey to throw in. The it seems to me with Norwich, it's pooky or nothing, and that's a pretty scary place to be when you're playing for Premier League survival. And I do wonder genuinely if Dean Smith maybe jumped at the job a bit quickly. You know, I think it was the shortest spell out of work for a manager before being appointed by another club, isn't it, in the Premier League? It was something like 13 days. And you kind of wonder if he should have just found a bit of bargain hunt and bided his time a little bit, because he's jumped into a role where it's very hard to see how you manufacture any kind of cohesive attacking threat at what he's got there. And I really do feel a sympathy for him watching last night, because he was watching a lot of what he'd created unpick the team that he's now got to make into something.
Yeah. Can't feel too sorry for him, though. 13 days out of a job, that's pretty impressive. Rest of the Premier League games this week. Wednesday night sees Brighton Wolves, Palace Southampton and Burnley Watford, as well as Arsenal West Ham. And then on Thursday, we've got Leicester Tottenham, Chelsea Everton and Liverpool Newcastle. We'll find out how many of those are likely to go ahead, because that's it for part one. In part two, we're going to be talking COVID cancellations. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, every year we reach out to you, our readers and listeners, and ask you to help us make a difference to people who really need it. And this year is no exception. The climate crisis is affecting our world in severe and unexpected ways, from flooding and drought to famine. And you can help people who've had their lives, their homes and whole communities devastated by the climate crisis by donating to our annual charity appeal. We're partnering with charities that are focused on grassroots initiatives and are reaching those directly affected by the climate crisis. Your donation will go straight to the people that will benefit from it the most. To donate, you can go to theguardian.com/charity2021 or speak to your favourite Guardian journalist during our annual charity appeal telethon. To do that, you can phone 0203 353 4368 on the 18th of December between 10 and 4pm. Barry, why weren't you on there?
I don't know. I was asked to do that once years and years ago. And I raised quite a lot of money and thought I did quite well, and I was never asked again.
Oh, we need to find out why. Bring back Baz. Bring back Baz.
No, I'm quite happy not to do it.
I thought you might be. Right, so Brentford Manchester United called off quite late, wasn't it, on Tuesday after a COVID-19 outbreak. The Premier League said the decision was made following guidance from medical advisers due to the exceptional circumstances. United shut down operations at Carrington just before that to try and minimise the risk of infection. It was probably inevitable after what happened with Tottenham's game against Brighton. But the Premier League have now brought in wider COVID restrictions. So Premier League players and club staff are going to have to take a lateral flow test every day to try and get into training grounds as part of new measures, which were agreed on Tuesday. So as well as those daily tests, players and staff also are going to have to take a PCR test at least twice a week. That was the case last season, of course, as well. There's going to be additional mask wearing. Limiting of time spent receiving physical treatment and social distancing is also being advised. The Premier League confirmed on Monday a record 42 positives over the previous 7 days. That's the highest figure recorded since testing began as part of Project Restart during the 19-20 season. So far, Brighton, Tottenham, Leicester, Aston Villa and Norwich all have confirmed cases. So that is the second match to be postponed. QPR also came out yesterday, postponed Saturday's home game against Swansea City. They have lots of COVID cases as well. That's their second postponement as well. They'd called off Monday's trip to Sheffield United. I mean, beyond increasing testing and all the measures that have been brought in, what more really can clubs do, Barry?
I don't really know, Faye. I mean, there seems to be some confusion over what exactly has to happen for a game to be postponed, you know, how many players have to be struck down. I think obviously the most important thing is the safety and good health of players. But I can see it worse before I can see it getting better, because as far as I can tell, half of London seems to be testing positive. With the time of year that's in it, people are going to be travelling all over the country to visit their families and whatnot, and I'm quite concerned about how things are going to pan out over the next 3 weeks.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Johnny, it's really difficult, isn't it? Because as Barry says, I think most of us are expecting it to get worse. But where, and I know this is the least important part of this, but we're a football podcast, that's what we're discussing. the amount of games that could potentially be postponed and where about in an already congested calendar you fit the rescheduled games.
And I was reading about Spurs, who obviously their game at Brighton was postponed. Their Europa Conference League game against Rennes was postponed. And so if they beat West Ham and get through to the Carabao semi-final, which are still somehow two-legged in 2022, then you know they've got a real issue, especially if they progress in, you know, if they're allowed to play the game against Rennes and that gets rescheduled. And
that's already been cancelled.
Yeah, I mean they said they were going to UEFA said they were just going to decide the result of that, right? But we still don't know. You know, we assume they're going to go out, but you know if they do stay in the competition, then obviously that complicates things, and. It does feel like we're going back slightly to the sort of the mid 2020 era and kind of the post lockdown return, when football felt like this incredibly fragile thing, and that again is quite a poignant state of affairs, because you know so many people rely on it. It's like it's this kind of weekly liturgy that we were just beginning to rely on again, and you know. There's something quite jarring about just having a football game whipped out from. And I was supposed to be at Brentford Manchester United last night, and about 2 days ago, it became fairly clear that it wasn't going to happen. And I was supposed to be at Brighton Spurs. So maybe I'm just speaking from my own point of view. But my life has been, you know, quite resoundingly disrupted over the last 3 or 4 nights. You know, if there's anything that football is good at, it's finding a way to put on fixtures. So whether it's, you know, making Everton play 3 times in 5 days or finding some biosecure dome to finish the season in, you can imagine they will find a way.
Well, I think I can speak for all of us when I say nobody wants Everton playing 3 times in 5 days across the board. I agree. Yeah, I think I could see something like that having to happen. I think I agree with everything everyone's saying. You know, obviously there's a bigger thing here. It's about, you know, keeping people safe, but there is also this double-edged sword of player welfare, where obviously we need to keep the players safe from COVID, we need to keep everyone around them, the playing staff, that's very important. There's also this risk that comes on the other side, where when we start cancelling so many games, the pile up of fixtures is going to add to this. The fact that is that players are playing too much football, and that is starting to manifest in injuries, and player welfare is being pushed back and back in the list of priorities. And I think what's really worrying is what probably would be the quickest solution would be to shut things down for a short period of time. And what do we do then with those fixtures? Well, most likely they stack up and we do start to have teams playing too regularly. And yeah, the worry is then, what does that do to the players, especially players who've maybe had to stop cold and then come back to playing fixtures again after a little break? As we said, there's more important things in the world. It's, you know, most important to keep people safe, but it's a really tough one, and it's quite sad to see things going back down that slightly scary route, where it's very hard to see what football does to keep this little window of normality in our lives that I think a lot of us really rely on for our, you know, mental health.
I had a suggestion, which is just relegate Norwich now. Just send them down. But also give them the rest of the season off. Free up a bit of space in the calendar. Thanks, Norwich. You had another go. You weren't very good again. Take your parachute payments. See you again back in the Premier League in 18 months.
And give Dean Smith time to sit and watch Bargain Hunt. It works on all fronts.
Brilliant. Listen, one player who won't have to worry about playing too much is Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, stripped of the Arsenal captaincy, replaced by Jonathan Liu, by the way. Congratulations. Your tardiness is nowhere near as bad as Aubameyang's. This is the full Arsenal statement. Following his latest disciplinary breach last week, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang will no longer be our club captain and will not be considered for selection for Wednesday's match against West Ham United. We expect all our players, particularly our captain, to work to the rules and standards we've all set and agreed. We're fully focused on tomorrow's match. So Arteta obviously dropped Aubameyang from the squad that beat Southampton on Saturday after he came home late from a trip abroad. At the time, he refused to take any questions on his status as club captain, but he did speak yesterday and said, "We've made this decision that unfortunately is a really tough one. If I had to choose, I wouldn't like to be sitting here talking about it, but we had to do it. When we have to make that decision, it's because it's the right one to defend the interests of the football club." Reading that statement and kind of reading between the lines, it felt quite cold. Referred to it as his latest breach, which I think is fair enough, you know, something that we've been talking about regularly this season. Does it spell the end for Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang? Because it feels like a bit of a long, slow death at the moment.
Yeah, it might do. I think given how Mikel Arteta constantly goes on about having a non-negotiable set of rules by which his players have to behave, he had no choice but to strip him of the captaincy. And we're at a stage now where Aubameyang isn't even an automatic first pick for Arsenal. The worry would be that there don't seem to be any obvious candidates to replace him, maybe Kieran Tierney or Martin Odegaard. But he doesn't look like he wants to be at Arsenal. We've been here before. We've seen this movie before with other players. And the only other thing I'd say is, I mean, it doesn't really matter who is captain of a football team. English people seem to place far more importance in it than anyone else. But you could argue also that one thing Arsenal consistently lack is leadership on the pitch. But Aubameyang clearly wasn't providing it.
Well, I mean, I think that's an interesting debate in terms of captaincy, but I think the role model aspect of it, you have to have a club captain that is a good role model. And I heard Nedim Manua say on the pod on Monday that Arsenal are showing that no one's above the law, and it sets the tone. And I think that is really important for them going forward on the pitch and off the pitch. But in terms of Aubameyang himself, I mean, he only signed a $350k a week deal very recently. Where does he go now, Paul?
Oh, you threw that at me.
Sorry.
I think it's easier for me to see how Arsenal get by without him than to see where he goes next. I think once you've marked yourself out as a troublemaker, it's quite hard to find the right coach for you. That said, I remember, you know, Thomas Tuchel has been very vocal about their time at Borussia Dortmund, and he talks about it as if it's some sort of, you know, with the beauty of hindsight, I'm sure he has a good laugh about how, you know, Aubameyang was never there on time, and, you know, we'd start meetings just before he arrived so that, you know, we'd set the time ahead of schedule so he'd be there on time. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of clubs around who wouldn't mind picking him up. I can't see an obvious one right now at Arsenal's level who would step in. I can much easier see how Arsenal could replace him. I'd go for Dusan Vlahovic from Fiorentina. I think he'd be a brilliant replacement, with the advantage of being 24. Because I think at this stage of your career, Aubameyang looks a lot less attractive than he would have done 6 years ago. You know, he's not a young striker anymore. So yeah, sorry to dodge the question a bit, but I guess for all these, we just say Newcastle, don't we, these days?
I mean, the interesting thing is that Arteta feels able to make this call and to kind of lay down the law at this point. I mean, what Aubameyang did is essentially what Aubameyang has been doing, which is essentially what a lot of Arsenal players have been doing for years now, which is, I guess, kind of indulging themselves. And that's a cultural flaw that began to seep in the late Wenger years. And when Unai Emery came in and then when Arteta came in, that culture was, it's not hard, you know, it's not easy to shift. And it's taken, I think, Arteta at least two seasons to really get the squad, a squad of players that he feels like he can work with, and where he feels like the vast majority of players are working for him, and that could kind of share his values and share his ethic, you know, work ethic. And that's not easy to do. You know, not all managers get that sort of time, because it's not easy to revamp a squad, and especially if you're under pressure for results. So it actually says quite a lot about how secure he feels in his position now, if he can say, right, this £350,000 a week striker who was, you know, the Golden Boot winner, we don't need him. we're going to bomb him out because he's making the place toxic. It seems like that's the sort of place where they're moving towards, because apparently they'll entertain offers for him in January. Not that I think they'll get any, but essentially it does feel like we're coming to the end of a cycle here.
Yeah, well, possibly Newcastle, as Paul said. And speaking of them, new Premier League sponsorship rules have come in. They've been approved by the Premier League to prevent inflated related party sponsorship deals. Angry opposition from Newcastle, who warned other clubs last week that the regulations could be legally challenged. So Newcastle and Manchester City both understood to have voted against these new rules at the Premier League stakeholders meeting on Tuesday, whereas all other 18 clubs voted in favour. What more do we know about this, Barry?
So basically, this is all very predictable, Faye. Newcastle and Manchester City, their owners and their fans are outraged as they look out for their own self-interest that owners and fans of the 18 other clubs who are not owned by states and not as wealthy as they are also nakedly looking out for their self-interest. This whole palaver relates to sponsorship deals, inflated related sponsorship deals, where theoretically a Middle Eastern airline might decide it wants to pay for the naming rights of a football club in the northwest of England, and rather than pay what the deal is worth, will hose money at, because the airline company is also owned by the same people who own the football club. So this will no longer be allowed, and deals have to be of fair market value. So if Newcastle wanted to sell the naming rights of St. James's Park to STC, the Saudi telecommunications company, or Saudi Aramco, who are also owned by their owners, they can only accept as much money as would be spent on similar deals by clubs similar in size. So I can see what Newcastle fans have a problem with, and I can also, because they're saying the cartel, the top six cartel, are looking after their own interests, I can also see what fans of the other 18 clubs are complaining about. But Amanda Staveley, Newcastle's chief executive, has sort of said this can be challenged in court. So it's basically a ploy to stop Newcastle breaking into the cartel by limiting the amount of money they can spend on sponsorship.
It certainly seems very kind of that regulation, or and the wording of it definitely seems very clear and unambiguous, and certainly legally watertight. I can't see any getting around that. To be honest, I think it's that sounds like game, set and match, to be honest. Fair market value. I mean, everyone knows what a fair market value is. I mean, the Premier League are kind of they have absolutely, they've kind of screwed themselves here in that all the stuff that they now want to restrict, they kind of let Manchester City do 10 years ago, and it was legal, and it was within the regulations, and it was also kind of morally dubious, but the Premier League let them get away with it because that was the culture of the place at the time, and that was the culture of the game at the time. And now Newcastle, well, we just want to do what they did, and I think the moral backlash now is slightly shriller, but essentially that's what they're saying. They managed to, they put their hand in the big lasagna and took a big handful of it and just shoved it in their mouths. Why can't we want to put our hand in the lasagna and take a big handful of it and shove it in our mouth as well? And
why the lasagna? Why a lasagna? Well, I was thinking cookie jar,
Oh yeah, partly the lasagna, because if I insinuate that there's been any kind of criminal or illicit behaviour, like they've done something genuinely nefarious, then they will sue me. They'll hire 50 lawyers and sue me to the next decade. So that's partly why I've chosen the fairly innocuous lasagna analogy there. But that's essentially where this ends, right? This ends in the Premier League saying this is a fair value for the stadium naming rights, and Newcastle saying no, it's not, and then saying, we'll sue you. and then football just kind of takes another turn to the gutter.
It is there's a slightly delicious irony about the fact that Newcastle fans were celebrating last week at the removal of all the Sports Direct branding from St James's Park after several long years. But now they're really, really looking forward to the introduction of sports brand or advertising branding from a far more tyrannical regime. But if you point that out to them, you're obviously just bitter and jealous.
Listen, no lasagnas were eaten in the making of this pod. And that is it for part two. Part three, a rather tasty, tasteless and slightly wrong Champions League draw. Welcome back to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. A software error, computer says no. Embarrassing for UEFA, really. Forced to redraw the last 16 of the Champions League after an error-strewn first attempt. Wrongly pitting Manchester United against Villarreal, first of all, excluding them from a possible tie with Atletico Madrid, and then pairing them with Paris Saint-Germain before Ralf Rangnick's side eventually landed Atletico at the second attempt. European football governing body blamed the software of an external service provider for what was a very embarrassing episode that involved the first draw being declared void after almost an hour and three quarters from when it started. I mean, it was pretty entertaining at the time, but quite a few clubs not very pleased. This is how it went. The initial draw: Benfica versus Real Madrid, Villarreal versus Manchester City, Atletico Madrid versus Bayern Munich, Salzburg versus Liverpool, Inter Milan versus Ajax, Sporting Lisbon, Juventus, Chelsea, Lille, and then Messi versus Ronaldo with Paris Saint-Germain against Manchester United. And, you know, we were all relatively excited about that, but it all went a little bit horribly wrong, Johnny.
Yeah, I mean, I have a take on this. I don't know if anyone wants to hear this, but...
Definitely want to hear this.
I think the rule that countries, teams from the same country can't play each other in the last 16, but can in the quarterfinals, I think that's the rule, right, is stupid and it should be changed. And it serves nobody's interest except the biggest leagues who essentially then colonise the last eight of the competition. Because if you are a team like Ajax or Benfica, you know, you're not going to benefit from that rule. The only beneficiaries of that rule are big teams like Manchester City or Real Madrid, who get to avoid their biggest domestic rivals, who also happen to be, you know, some of their biggest rivals for the competition. You know, you can see it. You can see why it works in the group stage. But what generally happens is that whichever league happens to be in the continental ascendancy at that point, ends up, you know, all their participants manage to avoid each other all the way through, and they end up getting you end up getting one country finals, which nobody wants. I think we've had five in the last nine seasons, where both finalists are from one country, and I think I'd much rather have that in the last 16 when there's genuine ignominy at stake. You know, you'd love to see Manchester City Chelsea at this stage of the competition, because, you know, it's going to be a disaster for one of them, and rather than having it in the final. So that's my take. I can't even remember what your question was.
Well, I was just asking what you thought about the shambles. But, you know, I think you've kind of just filled us all in. And I agree with you. It that would be a little bit more jeopardy.
I preferred the first draw to the second, marginally. There were some things to like about the second draw. But I think a couple more goes and they would have nailed it.
Well, Chelsea managed to still get Lille in the second draw. I'll just run through the actual draw for you. So Salzburg against Bayern Munich, Sporting Manchester City, Benfica Ajax, Chelsea Lille again, Atletico Madrid against Manchester United, Villarreal Juventus, Inter versus Liverpool, and then PSG, I'm sure, will be delighted to be facing Real Madrid. Which ties actually excite you the most, though, Barry? What are you looking forward to?
I always enjoy all the ties in the knockout stages of the Champions League.
That is such a Champions League weekly answer, by the way.
It really is.
That's like, go on, Baz.
That's Ivan Rakitic sitting in front of a camera going like, we respect every opponent.
Yeah. I mean, my own take on the shambles of the draw is that the reason it was a shambles is because UEFA bend over backwards to rig the competition as much as they can in favour of the bigger teams. There is no reason why this draw should not be just 16 teams, 16 balls in one bowl, just pick them out. You know, you're at home, you're away first. But because they're so obsessed with seeding and weighting the draws in favour of the big teams, this is what happens. Okay, I like watching Ajax play. So Benfica Ajax, I'm looking forward to that. Chelsea Lille is the one I'm quite not looking forward to. And obviously we're compelled to say PSG Real Madrid. That will be a fascinating tie.
What about you, Paul? I mean, who would you say are your favourites for the tournament this season?
Oh, that's a good question. I feel like I have this feeling that basically Liverpool are either going to lose to Inter or win the tournament. And I don't know if there's any logic to this rationale, but it partly comes from this second draw situation. So, I mean, I can hardly compete with Michael Owen, who said it best, I think, when he said, all the teams are going to get a better or a worse draw or the same team again.
Amazing.
That was Michael Owen at his absolute insightful best. But I think Liverpool, obviously having drawn Red Bull Salzburg, and not to be disrespectful to them, but I think that looked very much like a stroll. Suddenly they've ended up with Inter. And, you know, Inter atop Serie A, they're flying. I think they've scored nearly 100 goals in the calendar year. Even Alexis Sanchez is getting in on the act. He looks something like a very good player again. And I feel like it's the kind of tie that, especially if they can get fans into San Siro in February, I feel like it's the kind of tie where the wheels could come off for Liverpool. But by the same token, I feel like if they get through this, I think the competition suits Liverpool. And I think I could easily see them going on to win it all.
I mean, the slight sadness is that I think a lot of these ties, maybe half of them, maybe more, are kind of foregone conclusions, really. I mean, I stand to be corrected and would be very happy to be corrected, actually, because it means it's a bit exciting. But I can't see anything other than Chelsea, Manchester City, Bayern, and Ajax going through for starters. Juventus could be caused a few problems. But I find it fairly, like, perfectly conceivable that we could have four English teams in the last eight, possibly even three or four English teams in the last four, depending on how United shape up. And then of course you have Bayern, and to me those are your five contenders, really, the four English teams in Bayern. That kind of proves, you know, or sort of underlines my point earlier that when you have so much dominance from one country, and at the moment it happens to be England, it does make the end of the tournament feel kind of, you sort of dread it a little bit.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Europa League, standout ties, Barcelona-Napoli, Rangers, Borussia Dortmund and Porto-Lazio. Anyone want to discuss those?
Don't Dortmund and Celtic have this really long-standing friendship? I don't know whether I've just imagined that. Are Dortmund and Celtic friends?
I don't know.
Like, they're
what, do they invite each other round for Christmas or drinks, or what do you mean, friends?
I feel like they have some kind of unofficial kinship, although I don't.
Oh, like twinning?
Yeah, a bit like, you know, Dortmund and Liverpool fans. You know, they have a certain, you know, kinship, and Norwich and Sunderland fans. They, you know, they famously have this kind of friendly. Is it Norwich and Sunderland? They have this friendly derby, but I can't help thinking this. You know, this. I kind of think Dortmund and Celtic have this thing, which might conceivably add a little extra edge to this, to that tie.
You're making an old firm Europa League tie, are you?
Yeah, or the Rainer derby, the Rainer derby.
In the UEFA Conference League, Leicester have drawn Randers of Denmark. Celtic will play Bodo Glimt of Norway. And then we're still waiting on UEFA's verdict on Spurs' postponed game against Rennes to see whether or not it's Tottenham or Vitesse away to Rapid Vienna. Paul, tell us a little bit more about Kitmas. How did it go this year? How's your house looking kit-wise?
It's finally looking like a house people live in rather than a sort of offshoot of Classic Football Shirts warehouse. We had about 2,000 football shirts come in and out of the house. I was saying it's sort of a case of be careful what you wish for. Like, I've loved football shirts my entire life. I'm a bit of a football shirt nerd. But suddenly when you're looking at 2,000 of them in your living room, you lose a bit of the love for them, I think it's fair to say.
Mags wants to know what the best and worst looking kits you've come across this year are.
Right. The best one for me, one of the best was the Falkland Islands effectively national team football kit, which is made by a company called Hope and Glory, who are actually making some really beautiful kits. They're like a UK-based manufacturer. And these Falkland Islands shirts, they got in touch, the Falkland Islands FA got in touch, said, can we send you some kits? And I thought, well, it's going to take 3 weeks to get from Falklands. They came 2 days later. They got here faster than almost anything else because an RAF pilot was coming back to the UK and sent them from here. So we've got these beautiful Falkland Islands kits. They're lovely. On the other end of the spectrum, the ugliest actually was a Belgian handball team kit. And they've done this thing that you see a lot in South America where every sponsor has to go on the shirt. And there are just sponsors as far as the eye can see. But the two worst bits, if they've been sponsored by batteries, a battery company. And so you've got two big batteries drawn down the side of the shirt. You cannot imagine the meeting that took place where they decided it was a good idea. As random shirts go, a Belgian handball team probably wins it, but it's also an absolute eyesore. So every now and again, we do get sent a shirt that we just have to scratch our heads and think, I just don't know what child in their right mind wants that.
Brilliant. Tell us what's happening at Timpu City as well. Your consultant, international relations officer, sounds a little bit like a Ralph Ranick-esque role.
Yeah, I see myself as the Ralph Ranick of Bhutanese football. So with Timpu City, I came in only a few weeks ago, really, so I'm not getting to grips with it all. I sort of watched the end of last season. I was watching, while everyone else was watching sort of European games, I was watching Bhutanese football on online and saw them lose the title on the last ever season, which was brutal. And so now my role is sort of helping the club find opportunities for their young players to develop, but also helping financially to structure the club in a way that makes it sustainable. Because in Bhutan and also in Mongolia, there's a weird parallel with the UK. So when I had a club in Mongolia, it started out, all the clubs were very low budgets and more or less semi-pro to amateur status. And suddenly, sort of business tycoons started buying up clubs and using them as a status symbol and pumping what by those standards is a huge amount of money. It's about $100,000. But they blow all the other clubs out of the water, get bored, take their money away, the club would disband. In Bhutan, it's not quite as bad as that, but the clubs really struggle to be sustainable because the wage demands are higher than anything that the winning a tournament will get you. So it's interesting seeing how modern football, it's sort of a parallel. It's unsustainable in a different way. The sums of money may be a hundredth of what you're looking at as in the Premier League, but it's a really similar problem, I think. And trying to help them address that problem and make people... help people basically appreciate the value of local football, I suppose, is my passion.
Brilliant. Well, you've got a new fan in me, for sure. I'll be looking out to see how they're getting on.
Are you on live score?
we're not, but the amazing thing, at least the games are live. You can watch them on 11 Sports. They're about 11 a.m. on a Saturday or Sunday, so quite good times. When I was in Mongolia, the streams were so bad, they'd go off and on so much that when I wasn't in Mongolia, I had to text our subs to ask what the score was. And I remember one day I texted one of our subs to say, got him on Facebook, said, what's the score? Got this one back saying 4-0. I was like, yeah, 4-0. He said, to them. And then his next comment was, bring me on.
Right, let's end the pod with a couple of uncomfortable listener emails, shall we? Mike Pollitt said, I've just heard Max say, if anyone can beat that for uncomfortable times that they've listened to the podcast, please get in touch. And in spring 2018, I had 4 weeks in hospital with, amongst other injuries, an open book pelvic fracture, which remained unstabilised for the first two. Even with the morphine drip, I can't imagine that there are many more uncomfortable situations possible. And without wanting to stray into self-congratulation corner territory. Football Weekly was one of my few pleasures during that time, so much so that I still have a joyful Pavlovian reaction upon hearing the intro music. Cheers for that, Mike. Barry also says, and it's not our Baz, although this would be amusing, also on the topic of uncomfortable listens, I once had the pleasure of listening to the pod whilst getting my hip replaced after an accident. As I was under epidural and local anaesthetic, I was awake for the procedure. The sound of saw on bone became too much and only the dulcet tones of Rushton Glendenning et al. Could drown out the high-pitched whine. So thanks, Emil, and keep up the sterling work, Baz. Thankfully, during my C-section, I did not listen to Football Weekly, so that was not the most uncomfortable moment of the birth of my son. Anyway, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Baz, as always.
You're welcome.
Johnny Lou.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Try and be on time.
Sorry.
Enjoy your lasagna. Paul Watson, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, as well. We'll be back on Friday. Max, in fact, will be back on Friday.
This is The Guardian.